Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Well Women Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Laura. As you can see, I'm doing it a little bit differently format-wise for this episode. And the reason being is I wanted to offer more formats. So I'm obviously having this on my podcast, the Well Women Podcast, but I'm also wanting to have this as a recording so that for those of you who would rather watch a video or are more inclined to watching a video, you have the option. So I'm going to try to do this as much as possible when it comes to my podcast episodes being available as both audio and video. Now, today's episode is a little bit different because usually what I stick to in terms of my format is giving you information from a naturopathic medicine standpoint and kind of giving you the facts, the research, all of that, the evidence, etc. Today, I want to get a little bit more personal, and mainly because I've been asked by a lot of patients and a lot of other people to kind of elaborate on my personal pregnancy journey because they feel that that would be helpful for them and for others and kind of go through my experiences. So currently, I am almost 23 weeks pregnant, so I'm well into my second trimester. And I want to just go through kind of, I'll start with more of the medical portion of it, kind of going through the hormone changes and things you may experience early in pregnancy and beyond. And then I'll kind of dive into the specifics on what I've experienced, what's been the most trying things for me, and kind of what I do as of now to kind of get through my pregnancy, the types of foods I'm eating, the types of exercising that I'm doing, to kind of get through everything. So let me know if you have any questions. As always, you can send a message to Laura at laurapiper.com. You can also send a message on Instagram to at Dr. Laura ND. So let's just get started. We'll jump right in. Starting with the first trimester, this is when women, a lot of women, have most of their symptoms, and mainly the well-known symptom is nausea and vomiting. And really, I didn't personally have any of that, so I kind of lucked out on that front. But a lot of times, this is said to be due to all the hormonal changes that you're experiencing. So, I mean, obviously, we experience a lot of different hormonal changes during pregnancy, early pregnancy specifically. And so, what happens? I'm going to name a few of the important key things, but we obviously have an estrogen and progesterone increase. Now, progesterone does both estrogen and progesterone do a variety of things, but progesterone can act as a muscle relaxant, can prepare the uterine lining for, I mean, it's a progest hormone, so it's going to prepare the uterus for gestation and for your pregnancy. However, a downside of progesterone is that it's more of a muscle relaxant, so it's going to slow things down. And one of the things that it slows down is actually your digestive system. So that can lead to constipation, which a lot of pregnant women experience. And it's also associated with irritability and mood swings. So those pregnancy mood changes that you experience are more often than not due to the actions of progesterone. Estrogen is shown to maintain the endometrial lining. So, again, it's helping to balance progesterone. It's helping to keep things in play with respect to the pregnancy, but it also helps to increase blood flow. And so, you may have noticed if you are early pregnancy or if you're later in pregnancy, your blood volume increases a ton. This can actually make your breasts tender. This can lead to a stuffy nose, and that's because the swelling of the mucous membranes in your nose. It can cause your kidneys to process more fluid because with more volume, we have more fluid, and that can equal more washroom trips. A lot of women think that they only are increasing their washroom trips, having to pee all the time in later pregnancy, but that's actually not true. That can happen early on in your first trimester when your body's processing all this extra fluid as a baseline. The extra blood flow has also been shown to give you that pregnancy glow, and usually that happens in the second trimester. And I'm going to touch a little bit more on that with respect to my specific experiences, but this is kind of the facts and the hormone changes that most women experience throughout their pregnancy. Now, another great hormone, and the one that's very specific to being pregnant, is called HCG. This actually rises rapidly within the first 8 to 11 weeks, gets to its peak. And this is basically how you know you're pregnant. This is what will show up on a pregnancy test as positive. It's looking for that HCG. So that will kind of be the biggest thing in early pregnancy. That's kind of how they determine whether or not you're pregnant, and then they do the ultrasounds and all that sort of thing. And the last hormone is thyroid hormones. These actually increase because we need to support baby's neurodevelopment and bone development. So it is important to have that increase in your thyroid hormones. And if you already are on thyroid medication, your doctor will have to adjust your medication as you go through pregnancy. You'll notice your thyroid will change. Once we get in the second trimester, relaxin kicks in. So this actually relaxes your smooth muscles, but it also can give you those ligament pains because it's also relaxing your pelvis, your cervix, your uterus, and it's helping to promote growth of the placenta. Now you might actually notice a lot of stretching pains and pulling pains into the second trimester because of this relaxin. It can cause women to be able to do yoga a little bit better. You might find yourself more flexible, but it also can cause aches and pains of your ligaments. At this point, your hair may begin to grow. So a lot of women will report having thicker, fuller, more luscious hair. Other women don't really notice a change, but at this point, you're usually not losing any hair. Another interesting thing is we've all heard of our stress hormone, cortisol, and not many people actually know that cortisol increases during pregnancy. This is shown to help with the developing fetus, but it can also be associated with stretch marks and increased blood pressure. So depending on how the rest of your hormones are being regulated, this can be a good thing, but it also can be a negative thing for those who have changes that are too much or beyond what's expected. So estrogen and progesterone tend to peak around week 32. So as you're kind of rounding out that third trimester, getting to the end of things, week 32, estrogen and progesterone peak. This can actually contribute to swelling. So a lot of women at the end of their pregnancy have or will experience swelling. And so if they do, then that can be attributed to the estrogen and progesterone peaks. So now getting into kind of my personal journey, I want to highlight a couple things that in my opinion, I think nobody really tells you about pregnancy. The hormonal changes are one thing, and a lot of the common symptoms are another: heartburn, constipation, nausea, those sorts of things. But I really want to get into kind of the nitty-gritty. So first things first, I'm going to start with the biggest question people ask you when you're pregnant is, how are you feeling? And this is a little bit, in my opinion, of a loaded question, because a lot of the time people are referring to how are you feeling from a nausea vomiting standpoint. Everybody associates pregnancy with nausea, vomiting, puking. All the movies kind of show women puking on the side of a toilet, puking in a garbage can, and that's why you know they're pregnant, is because of that. So a lot of times people ask how you're feeling, and if you aren't nauseous or vomiting or have been, it's kind of assumed that you're having a really great pregnancy. And I think that that was one of the biggest things I struggled with in my first trimester, and even into a bit of the second trimester, is that how are you feeling question. And obviously in the first trimester, you're not really telling anyone you're pregnant, and I will get into that a little bit more. But when people ask you how you're feeling, it is that loaded question, because there are a lot of things that you feel when you're pregnant, and a lot of people don't talk about anything beyond I was sick or I wasn't sick. So I find that, again, there's a lot of things that, especially if it's your first pregnancy, as I'm experiencing now, there's a lot of things that nobody brings up, nobody talks about, because it's just assumed, again, that if you're not sick, you're fine or you're having a great pregnancy. And so for me in my first trimester, like I said, I was fortunate enough to not be sick. I wasn't physically ill. I actually had the flu really early pregnancy, about five or six weeks. And that was awful. My husband went away to Chicago. He came back. Everybody got sick when he was away. And so when you're early pregnancy, your immune system is suppressed. And so my immune system really took me down, and I had a fever, I had chills, I had your typical flu. So that was really early pregnancy, and I really had to go through the pros and cons of keeping my fever down for the health of a new baby versus taking something to help my fever. So a lot of the time you hear me talk about how fevers aren't actually harmful and we don't actually need to treat a fever, yada, yada, yada. However, in pregnancy, the game kind of changes, and the risk of a high fever, especially in your first trimester, is actually more than taking something like Tylenol to reduce it. So Tylenol is the one thing that's recommended for pregnant women in pain and fever and that sort of thing. And so normally I wouldn't have taken anything, but because I knew I was early pregnancy, looking at the risk benefit analysis, I actually was taking Tylenol. I felt really, really crappy. So beyond, I wasn't nauseous, so that was good. I was able to kind of get on with my day in terms of that. But I did go through bouts of getting sick. I got cold sores. I got about, I would say in my first trimester, I had probably two or three colds plus the flu. So that wasn't pleasant, feeling like crap in kind of a different way. The main things I experienced were, first things, acne. I'm a person who has always struggled with skin issues, with acne off and on, and that seems to never go away. I kind of got myself to a really good place before getting pregnant and got myself through with diet and herbs and all the things that naturopathic doctors really excel at. And then as soon as I got pregnant, my hormones kind of shifted and brought me back right back to that place where my acne was kind of the worst it's ever been. And it was difficult, especially in my first trimester, being a naturopathic doctor and coming to work treating patients who may also have acne. Showing up with that acne. So I was feeling bloated. I was feeling kind of not myself. And here I had all these skin issues that I was telling patients I could help them with. And that was really difficult for me from an emotional standpoint, because at that point I wasn't telling anyone I was pregnant, but I was still trying to work and promote my business and what I do for a living while suffering from conditions that I'm trying to tell people I can treat. So that was a little bit hard for me at first. The acne, unfortunately, I can say for myself, has never really gone away. That pregnancy glow that you kind of expect that you get with pregnancy has never really been something that I've had. I've always struggled with acne. So unfortunately, it's something that's never gone away for me. So for a lot of women, it does go away. It does start in early pregnancy, and usually by the second trimester, things are kind of leveled out a little bit more and things are feeling better. In my case, unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. I've kind of gone through waves of it being worse, and then it kind of gets better, and then it gets worse again. But who knows what the rest of this pregnancy will hold in terms of that. The one thing that has gotten me through the acne portion is just making sure, again, my skincare is as clean as possible. I'm using products without parabens, products without any other endocrine disruptors, as natural as possible. And a few products, Derma-E has a really good acne line that has tea tree oil in it. So I've been using a little bit of that, but kind of just trial and error. Getting facials can be helpful, but really there's not much you can do about whatever changes your hormones will take in pregnancy. As unfortunate as that is. The second thing that I felt was huge in my first trimester, and actually into a bit of my second trimester, is the moodiness. And not just feeling irritable or anxious or anything like that, which those feelings are very, very real, and I felt those as well, but not feeling like myself. And this was hard to deal with, because for me, my personal pregnancy was planned. And so when you go from planning a pregnancy to getting pregnant and actually being pregnant, you kind of have this expectation versus what your reality actually is. It tends to be a little bit different, or a lot different. And for me, it very much was. Even though I had planned this, I had prepared for this, well, thought I had prepared for this mentally as much as you can. And then you're pregnant and you're going through all of these hormonal changes and you're really watching your body change. And we live in such a society where it is only acceptable to be a certain size or to fit in certain clothing. And even though in the back of your head, you know, I'm growing a life and this is beautiful and I'm feeling very blessed that I am able to do this, there's also another part of you that is watching your body bloat and watching things change and watching hair grow where hair doesn't normally grow and watching things stretch. And so that I found was really difficult. And I actually found now that I'm 23 weeks, I'm actually very visibly showing. So I don't find it as difficult because a lot of people will just associate it with a baby bump. And that's kind of that. But when you're early pregnancy, especially the first trimester, I know a lot of women and a lot of my friends were able to wear their regular clothes actually throughout their whole pregnancy, which good for you if you can do that. I actually have been in maternity leggings since I was about 10 weeks pregnant. Reason for that was not because my clothes didn't fit, but the way that I was gaining weight or gaining bloat, I guess, at the beginning, you're really getting extra water and that sort of thing, kind of preparing the body. And I gained a lot of very low abdominal bloat, I would call it. So a lot of women compare their first trimester or their first few weeks up to, I guess, week 11 or 12 to just looking like they ate a big meal. And that can be discouraging because you're kind of walking around in your regular clothes that don't really fit you. You feel kind of bloated, but nobody knows that you're pregnant because A, you're not telling anyone, and B, you don't really look pregnant at that point. You don't have a baby bump as of yet. So I actually found the first trimester to be very trying from a mental, emotional standpoint. I found that my anxieties were huge. Among feeling about the ways I felt about myself, I actually felt anxiety about the pregnancy on its own because it's a lot of unknowns. It's a lot of things going on with your body that you have literally no control over. So on top of the feeling like I have 85 different personalities and not feeling like myself, number two, watching my body grow and change in a way that I've never seen it before, while worrying about the pregnancy and hoping and praying that this is going to be a successful pregnancy and a healthy pregnancy and all of those things that you wish for when you have a baby, I found it very emotionally taxing. So that's kind of first trimester for me wasn't nausea or vomiting, like I said. It was a lot of that mental, emotional stuff that I feel like people don't talk about enough. And so coming back to that first question I asked, or I asked myself, however lots of people were asking me, is how are you feeling? You kind of go back to all of the things I just said and you ask yourself, how do you answer that question? So a lot of times I just found myself saying, I'm good, I'm okay, I'm fine. Because at the end of the day, unless somebody really wants you to elaborate on all of the things I've just said, everybody just wants to hear that you're doing good, you're not throwing up, and it's not really, there's no malintent in that, but it's really hard to not have anyone to kind of vent that out to. So thankfully, and you can decide on who you want to tell first or who you want to go to when you're originally pregnant. Obviously, I told my husband, that was the first person I told, and then around 5 or 6 weeks, I actually decided I wanted to tell my mom because my mom and I have a really close relationship and I really wanted someone to confide in who had been through this before. As a doctor, it makes it really difficult learning things from a book and knowing how to treat patients and successfully treat patients throughout their pregnancy. But feeling it yourself and having no outlet or things that feel like you have no outlet can be really, really difficult. The other thing is heartburn. A lot of people talk about heartburn later on in pregnancy. I experienced mine very, very early, and I think that kind of went with a lot of the aversions that I experienced as well. So for me, it was a lot of, I couldn't eat a lot of meat. Chicken was the main thing. I had a serious aversion to chicken. So my husband and I ended up eating a lot of more vegetarian plant-based meals because that's kind of what my body was wanting. So lots of fresh fruit, lots of fresh veggies. However, I then quickly went through a phase where everything was giving me heartburn, fresh fruit, fresh veggies, healthy stuff, unhealthy stuff. I could have a bagel and cream cheese and have heartburn. I could have watermelon and berries and have heartburn. So, everything was giving me heartburn. I ended up calling my midwife and saying, what should I do about this? Because I know the root cause of this is my pregnancy. So how can we deal with this right now? And she suggested Tums. And so I actually just kept Tums on me and kind of used it as I needed it. And then I was very mindful about getting in my nutrients. So what I ended up doing for a good solid chunk of time was doing a lot of juicing, a lot of smoothies and soups and stews, just so that I can guarantee that I was absorbing nutrients and I didn't have to worry about the heartburn that I was getting from eating just regular food, and it really didn't matter what it was. So that really helped me a lot. I kind of got over that wave after maybe early second trimester, maybe week 13 or 14, and I could go back to kind of eating how I was eating, which was just, again, a lot of fresh fruit, a lot of veggies, and then, don't get me wrong, indulging when I wanted to, I can't really eat ice cream, but getting frozen yogurt or a dairy-free ice cream or another sort of treat that I wanted. I didn't deprive myself by any means, but my priority was really kind of getting in the fruits and vegetables and making sure that I wasn't giving myself indigestion or heartburn, because again, that wasn't something that I had to deal with prior to pregnancy and was kind of a big shock to have to deal with so often. The one thing that I feel like women don't really talk about, and going back to the mood portion, is, like I mentioned, the anxiety about the actual labor, or sorry, the anxiety about the actual pregnancy in your first trimester. So I am under the care of midwives, so I am seeing midwives now a lot more frequently. But in the beginning of your pregnancy, in the beginning of anyone's pregnancy, you really only see your doctor when you first find out you're pregnant. And so for some women, for me, that was right away. And then you see, then you get your requisitions and you go for an ultrasound around 8 weeks. But for some women, it can be later on because you cannot know you're pregnant until you're 8 weeks or so, or whatever else. And so for me, I found the first trimester really trying because I felt like I was pregnant for a long time, and I felt like I was by myself because I didn't have the support of my midwife really until after my 8 week ultrasound. And even after your 8 week ultrasound, the next thing you do is go for your 12 week ultrasound. So there's a lot of time to wait, to stew about things, to have certain symptoms that aren't a big enough deal to call anyone. So it's not like you're severely cramping or bleeding or think you're miscarrying, but you have a lot of questions about, again, I had a lot of questions about my mood and my feelings and my anxieties and about statistics, because I'm so used to looking at the evidence and looking at the research. I was a little bit overwhelmed with a lot of statistics and research and looking into everything. And so I understand from someone else's point of view who may not know the proper resources to go to, that can be really, really overwhelming. So I actually have a lot of patients that will come see me early pregnancy because they have all of these questions before they've seen their midwife or they've seen their OB or whatever they choose to do. They have a lot of questions about a lot of these things, like I said, that women don't talk about. And so the one thing that I actually experienced was called a subchorionic hematoma. And so I honestly had no idea what this was. So kind of backtracking a bit, my pregnancy was quite normal, I would say. The beginning, I found out I was pregnant right when I could. I saw my medical doctor. They sent me for blood work. I did all my routine blood work, and then I signed on with the midwives. They saw me just before my 8 week ultrasound, and then we followed up with the 8 week ultrasound, and I've been with my midwives ever since. And so when I originally did my 8 week ultrasound, they actually found something called a subchorionic hematoma. And so what that is, basically, it's when the placenta doesn't actually attach to the uterus properly. So what's supposed to happen is it's supposed to attach flush to the side of the uterus. And so sometimes what happens is the placenta doesn't attach all the way and there's a little bit of a gap between there. And so a lot of women will actually experience bleeding or spotting, and that's early pregnancy. A lot of times they think they're miscarrying, but actually it's just this subchorionic hematoma. And so these can go one of two ways, is these can actually resorb, and a lot of them actually just kind of resorb and the placenta attaches and you kind of go on with your pregnancy, and some of them can result in miscarriage. And so Mine was interesting because it was actually found incidentally on ultrasound. I didn't have any bleeding or spotting or anything else, but on my 8-week ultrasound, they had seen there was a small subchorionic hematoma. So when I spoke with my midwife about that, she had let me know that that was found on the ultrasound and I may or may not experience some bleeding going forward, and it may or may not resolve on its own, or it may get worse. And so now I'm left with all of these thoughts in my head that it may get worse. I may bleed. So now here, every time I'm going to the washroom, I'm expecting bleeding or spotting because it's something I didn't have before. I'm scared I'm now going to miscarry. And now I have to wait 4 more weeks, which was the longest 4 weeks of my life, to have this next ultrasound to kind of see where things were at. And so I started looking at the statistics because, again, this was actually, I took a maternal and newborn course while I was at the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. So we learned about pregnancy and everything to do with that. But I had never heard of a subchorionic hematoma. So I kind of started doing my own research to see what I was dealing with. And so these are quite interesting. And a lot of them are, I mean, up to 25% of women, pregnant women, can experience symptoms of a threatened miscarriage. Mostly this is in the first trimester. And so this can be bleeding with or without contractions. Now, I mentioned that I wasn't bleeding, so it was kind of a strange situation. But the most common ultrasound abnormality in these women who are bleeding is the subchorionic hematoma. So, what I had just explained. And it's a collection of the blood between the chorionic membrane and the uterine wall. Now, like I said, some can be asymptomatic, but some can be associated with vaginal bleeding, and that'll be kind of your first red flag. You see spotting, and obviously you call your doctor because the first thing you think is you're miscarrying. And so these can actually, like I said, go one of two ways. And from the research, a small minority of women can actually have a persistent subchorionic hematoma that remains symptomatic, i.e., they're bleeding, up until delivery. And so that can be scary for a lot of women, and not knowing this beforehand can really throw you through a loop when you realize that you now are bleeding your entire pregnancy and you're always wondering, is this a miscarriage? Is this a problem? Should I be doing anything about that? And so looking at the research of the outcomes of this, because really that's all we care about, is if this is happening, what does that even mean? What does that lead to? And so the research is actually mixed. When I was kind of looking into it, two small studies did not find that subchorionic hematomas increased miscarriage rate. In one of these studies, there were no miscarriages in all 22 cases of women who had these. So this study did not differentiate how big or how small these women's subchorionic hematomas were. They just said, in all 22 women who had these, none of them miscarried. Also, they found that it did not increase the risk of miscarriage in patients who had recurrent miscarriages. So in women who have been trying to get pregnant and keep having miscarriages, having a subchorionic hematoma in another pregnancy did not increase the risk of having a miscarriage again. The other thing I found interesting was that subchorionic hematomas are found in up to 50% of women who are going through in vitro fertilization, so IVF. So if you are doing that, just be aware that this can happen and it doesn't mean that you have a poor outcome in your pregnancy. Another one, they looked at women with a subchorionic hematoma did not have a higher risk of stillbirth either. So again, another study I looked at actually found a small increased risk of miscarriage within the first 20 weeks of pregnancy. However, it did not affect the pregnancy outcome of ongoing pregnancy. So, i.e., if it went away or if it kind of just continued at a small size, it actually was shown that it didn't impact the outcome of your pregnancy. It didn't make any fetal malformations happen. It didn't leave babies to come out preterm or too small or too big or anything else for that matter. So, looking at the research for me helped ease my fears because I thought, okay, it's not actually, it doesn't mean XYZ if you have this. So, for those who have had this before or have bleeding, obviously it's so important. You need to speak with your midwife or OB. That's kind of a non-negotiable. But if they do tell you that this is the diagnosis, don't don't automatically think that this means miscarriage. And now miscarriages happen for a variety of reasons, and none of those reasons have to do with you or your pregnancy or anything you're doing in your pregnancy. So remember that. However, as a person who likes the evidence and likes to look into things, I know I didn't do anything to cause this, but I wanted to know what my risk factors were. So I found that very helpful looking into that. And a lot of people I know don't really know where to look and how to analyze the research. So I wanted to give that information so that anybody who's wondering doesn't have to feel alone or doesn't have to feel like they're the only one that had these symptoms. And actually, I found as I started kind of talking to friends and family, a lot more people started opening up to me about how they had a spotting, or they had actually a lot of bleeding their first trimester, or they bled into their second trimester, or they found this. And all of those stories and all of those people I spoke to anecdotally have healthy babies and had fine labor and delivery. So just know that it doesn't mean that a certain outcome is going to happen with your pregnancy if you are, or if you happen to be diagnosed with a subchorionic hematoma in your pregnancy. And so the next thing I wanted to go on to was thoughts about labor and delivery. And again, going back to the mood stuff, this has been giving me, as of recently, actually, if I'm being completely honest, a lot of anxiety. Again, being a doctor, being very evidence-based, always wanting to look at the research, I'm not the type of person that's just willing to let things happen how they happen, which in this case, you have no choice but to do that. And so it's been really, really difficult for me to get behind the idea of understanding that my body knows what it needs to do, and my body will do what it needs to do when it's ready. When this baby is full term and ready to go, he will make his entrance, and my body will really have no choice but to let him. And so that's been really, really difficult to wrap my head around. And I know a lot of people who are similar to me, who are a lot more analytical and want to know the facts about things, can have a really hard time with labor and delivery and the thoughts of labor and delivery. And so a few of the things I've been doing to kind of get myself through that, one of the fears is the unknown. I mean, obviously everyone is so scared of the unknown. You're worried about what you don't know, and that's completely fair. It's completely valid and it's completely normal. But to get through that, I've been doing a lot of self-reflection. One of my colleagues and friends actually recommended getting some positive affirmations regarding birth. And everyone has a story to tell when it comes to their birth or labor and delivery, and whether they're positive or negative. The best thing, and the best thing for my mental health and my sanity, was actually to just shut everyone out and to ignore everybody's stories, unless they were really, really good, really positive, and really inspiring. I have actually just kind of ignored everyone else and let them tell their story if they want to tell it, but not made it my story, because I felt like I was taking on a lot of that at first with all my what ifs and what ifs of different stories and different people's the tale that they tell. So I found that gravitating towards people who were willing to tell me positive stories, whether they were true or not, it has been the most helpful thing, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what people tell you. It's going to happen how it happens, and it's going to be a means to an end. And thinking as the contractions as things, as something that will end and something that will peak and something that will fall, has been really helpful. So I actually subscribed to a positive affirmation. It's basically a free site online through a hypnobirthing website, and they email me a positive affirmation every day about how I'm ready for this baby. The transition will be smooth. This baby will come when he's ready. My body is made to do this. I love my pregnant body. And a different affirmation every single day that can really help you to kind of get through that. And it's been really helpful for me. So if you're like me and you need kind of the affirmations, that's a really, really good thing to do, is I get an email every single day. The other thing a colleague and friend of mine suggested is she actually took positive affirmations and had them up on her computer and printed them out so she could actually tape them around her house. And so I thought that was pretty cool. She kind of taped them all around her house so that when she was walking around her house pregnant, she could read all these positive affirmations that were related to a positive, healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby. And so that really helped her. The other things that I do are prenatal yoga and meditation. The app I actually use for my pregnancy is called The Bump. And so that kind of brings you through milestones of your pregnancy. You can add in photos and that sort of thing. But the sister app that The Bump offers is actually called Mind The Bump. And so that's a really, really great mindfulness app. And it allows you to meditate and add in meditation daily. You can do it whenever you want, but they're as short as 5 minutes, as long as 10 minutes long. And you really just have to throw in some headphones, sit in somewhere quiet and comfortable, and go through your meditation. And I really like it because it is regular meditation and mindfulness, but helps to be specific to pregnancy and the feelings that you feel towards pregnancy. So that's been helpful as well. With respect to exercises that I'm doing, I love to stay active. I feel like it's been the one thing keeping me sane. But you need to make sure that you're doing things that are safe for your pregnancy. So for me, I've been doing I've downloaded an app and it's called Baby to Body. It's actually a paid app, but I really, really have been liking it. They tailor exercises to your level of fitness. So they let you put in your level, your fitness level, and then you kind of just go through it. You give a goal of how many times a week you want to do an exercise, and they'll kind of set your goal based on that. And then you just kind of go through the workout on your phone. All you need is a space at home, some light weights. I have 2 pounds, 5 pounds, and 8 pounds, and that's been enough. I have a exercise ball and a yoga mat. And so I'll just do that. My goal is about 4 times a week, and I don't always make that goal, but I also walk my dog every single day. So between walking, I usually end up adding in one of their weighted workouts, I would say about average 2 to 3 times a week. And when I'm having a really good week, 4 days a week. But the take home point from that really is that you need to listen to your body, and you need to know that the days you feel tired and you are exhausted and you feel like you don't want to work out, you do not have to. If you really want to move, you could again go for a nice walk and or do a stretch or do a prenatal yoga, find a YouTube channel, anything that makes you feel good. But I think the main thing to take home about pregnancy is to make sure you are listening to your body, always listening to your body, and doing what you know is right for you, because people can tell you so many things, but you need to do what's right for you. The thing I do like about the Baby to Body app is that it's pregnancy safe exercises. So you know you're not doing anything that's going to harm the baby, or you're not doing anything on your stomach, or laying flat on your back, doing like chest flies or anything like that. So that's what I really enjoyed about and still enjoy about that app. And then on top of that, like I mentioned, prenatal yoga has been really good. The last thing I want to talk about is how I've been eating and managing cravings and that sort of thing, because a lot of my patients have been asking, how do I make sure I'm getting enough nutrients, or how do I manage my cravings? So I found that the number one thing I did is make sure I'm on my right supplements. So in that case, that's my prenatal, my omega-3, my probiotic. And I actually have a podcast episode talking about the nutrients and the different stuff that you should be taking with respect to pregnancy. So you can go ahead and listen to that if you are interested. But on top of my supplements, I'm just making sure, again, listening to my body, I always keep fresh berries and fruit in the fridge, because that allows me to have something sweet that's good for my blood sugar, that gives me fiber. And it's a really, really quick snack. If I can just grab some blueberries and wash them and eat them as a snack, that's been really good. Making sure I'm adding in fiber. So whether I'm having oatmeal for breakfast or all bran with almond milk or something like that, that can be really beneficial. Jam-packing my day with salads and bowls. Lots of stuff with like quinoa as a base or brown rice as a base, with lots of veggies and spinach or spring mix. Making a lot of my own dressings, whether I'm just keeping it simple with balsamic and olive oil, or I'm making a tahini dressing or a mustard dressing with, again, like apple cider vinegar, olive oil, that sort of thing. Just making sure that I'm keeping my diet varied. So I find that I just kind of make sure I have lots of fresh fruits and veggies in the fridge, and then I can pull together salads and things like that when I'm in a rush. having lots of snacks like energy balls, slicing up an apple with peanut butter, putting some hemp hearts on there, just making sure you're kind of varying your sources of protein between if you're eating meat or not, nuts, seeds, legumes, adding in healthy oils, lots of fat and protein, avocados, eggs are really great, really easy. And just kind of, again, listening to your body and seeing what you feel. Some days I don't feel like that. Some days, like I said, I'll eat a bagel and it's not the worst thing ever. So at the same time, you want to be eating healthy. You also want to make sure that you're giving yourself a little bit of a break and being kind to yourself. So that's kind of my, I guess, overview of pregnancy and how pregnancy was to me. I think I explained kind of where I'm at and how I'm kind of getting through. So I hope this was helpful. If you have any other questions or want me to elaborate on anything else, feel free to reach out. Feel free to send me an email, laura@laurapiper.com. You can comment if you were watching the video, comment on the video if you have anything else you want to add. Thanks, guys. Bye.